You're listening to This Way Up, a podcast from the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre. We are a global NGO with research experts in more than 20 countries, pushing for greater human rights accountability in business. Our second series is hosted by Elizabeth Dykstra McCarthy, a former member of the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre Natural Resources team, who is now consulting on climate action and environmental issues around the world. Along with several special guests, she'll delve into the social impact of the transition minerals boom, the pitfalls of futuristic methods of mineral extraction, and the capacity of communities to hold companies accountable for abuse, all in search of answers to the question, what is the true cost of clean energy?
The climate crisis is upon us. With it comes the urgent need to decarbonize and transform our economies from those reliant on fossil fuels to greener, cleaner sources of energy. Governments and companies around the world and droves of concerned citizens are driving this transition forward for the good of the planet, its people, and its creatures. But not all people will benefit equally. As the renewable energy transition accelerates, what will the challenges be? Who might the hidden victims be? And what can we do now to make this transition as just as possible?
Pacific countries are gathering in Tonga this week for a series of talks about the future of seabed mining in the region. A number of countries, including Papua New Guinea, Nauru and Cook Islands, are looking to exploit minerals on the seafloor, and some exploratory projects have already begun.
These are things we take very seriously as an island state, as an ocean people. We're certainly not going to conduct any sort of exploitation of our minerals if it causes any environmental damage. That just will not occur.
The Cook Islands Exclusive Economic Zone contains an estimated 10 billion tonnes of nodules on the seafloor, which are rich in manganese, nickel, copper, cobalt, and rare earth minerals. Some of these are required for batteries for electric vehicles, so interest in them is growing.
As the renewable energy transition accelerates around the corner, attention is focusing on scaling it up, where speed and quantity are the order of the day. This is driving a scramble for minerals across the globe, with governments and private sector companies rushing to source and sell the untapped resources that might lie beneath us. But where do we get these minerals? As the last few episodes have explored, regardless of commodity or country, there are some entrenched issues around mining for these minerals. These issues have caused environmental degradation and health problems, destroyed livelihoods and drive displacement, contributed to conflict, corruption and deepening inequalities. It is little wonder, then, that alternative sources are being considered.
So it's these things that are driving a lot of the larger multinational companies, the car manufacturing companies, to look at sources where they're getting cobalt. And currently, some of these sources out of Africa, for example, are not harvested in the most environmentally safe way or in socially accepted ways, which makes exploring our minerals an option for some of these companies.
That was Mike Brown, the Prime Minister of the Cook Islands. He's referring to the minerals in the deep seabed of the Pacific Ocean, a potential source of rare earth minerals for the renewable energy transition, which has yet to be tapped into. When considering alternatives to the traditional terrestrial mines, three main solutions are proposed: space mining, deep sea mining, and urban mining. While space mining sounds pretty exciting, as the image of moon and asteroid mining amongst the stars does have a certain glamour to it, it isn't quite yet around the corner. Space missions haven't fully explored the extent of a significant excavation. The sum total of all NASA's Apollo missions had been less than 400 kilograms. NASA and the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, JAXA, have so far been able to capture dust from asteroids, and that is considered a major achievement. The cost so far seems prohibitive, and the feasibility a while away. All of this means that whilst it may happen in the future, and has its own challenges to meet, off-Earth mining won't provide a solution in time for the renewable energy transition. Instead, most of the discussion has focused on deep-sea mining. But don't forget about that third, urban mining. We'll be coming back to that later.
Deep sea mining is basically mining for minerals in the deep sea bed.
This is Helen Rosenbaum of the Deep Sea Mining Campaign, an association of NGOs and citizens from Australia, Papua New Guinea and Canada, concerned about the likely impact of DSM on marine and coastal ecosystems and communities. DSM, or deep sea mining.
Technically, the sea is defined as deep below 200 metres, but where these mining companies have got their sites on the seabed is more around the, typically in the Pacific Ocean, for example, between 3 and 6 kilometres under the surface of the ocean. And there's three types of substrates that mining companies are looking at digging up the ocean floor for. The one that's garnered the most interest are these roundish rocks called polymetallic nodules. There's vast fields of these nodules in a zone called the Clarion-Clipperton Zone of the Pacific Ocean.
Companies have begun to explore the deep sea bed, but the impacts are unknown, which is why Helen has been campaigning and focusing on informing the response to deep sea mining in the region, and achieving free, prior and informed consent from the affected communities. Recently, the Deep Sea Mining Campaign published a report on DSM where an extensive literature review of over 250 current scientific articles and reports were reviewed to analyse the state of play and current thinking around deep sea mining.
Our recent report was focusing on the impacts of mining polymetallic nodules in the Clarion-Clipperton Zone of the Pacific Ocean. So we specifically looked at that kind of substrate and the ecosystems that relate to that substrate because of the high level of interest by companies in that area and in polymetallic nodules.
These zones are, definitionally, under the sea, so it can be a little hard to imagine what that looks like. For reference, the Clarion-Clipperton Zone is roughly the size of the United States.
So the area of the ocean that has a rich abundance of these polymetallic nodules is an area of the Pacific Ocean from around Hawaii and Kiribati on one side across to Mexico on the other side, roughly speaking. So that's an area that's about 4,500 kilometres across.
Of that 4,500 kilometres, it is possible to look at maps from the International Seabed Authority to see where mining companies have current exploration licences. About a quarter of that expanse is earmarked for exploration, a long band of 1,000 kilometres, which has been deemed of commercial interest and held by 31 mining companies.
One mine was a proposal by a company called Nautilus to mine hydrothermal vents at about a depth of 1.5 kilometres under the ocean surface. It was the first mine to be granted a license to actually exploit the mineral resources. The deep sea mining campaign really targeted Nautilus and the Solwara 1 mine as a precedent. The eyes of the world and the governments that were considering seabed mining at that time when it was first licensed over 10 years ago now were really watching to see what was happening in Papua New Guinea and what we worked with local communities to ensure that happened was that the company was not going to get an easy ride. To this day, that mine has not gone ahead. The company Nautilus has been declared bankrupt. That has been in large part due to the resistance of the communities and the fact that finance institutions know about the lack of social license that this enterprise had, and no serious financier would undertake the environmental risks and the political and social risks involved with that seabed mine.
Helen first became aware of the dangers to island and coastal communities when the Solwara 1 deep-sea mine was proposed by Nautilus in the Bismarck Sea. What underpinned the campaign work there was the application of the precautionary principle, the principle that where there are threats of serious or irreversible damage, lack of full scientific certainty shall not be used as a reason for postponing cost-effective measures to prevent environmental degradation. In other words, just because we aren't 100% confident that irreversible damage will be caused, we shouldn't charge blindly ahead. This is the sentiment that has driven the Deep Sea Mining Campaign's research and their most recent report.
So the report reviewed over 250 peer-reviewed and other articles and was able to categorically state that the consensus of the scientific literature was that the impacts of deep sea mining were likely to be severe, long-term, and in human timeframes, largely irreversible.
And what kind of impacts did they project, or reason would be likely, and why?
So that encompasses both direct impacts on the ecosystems that exist around the polymetallic nodules and also impacts of waste discharges into what's called the midwater column or midwater body.
In the deep sea mining report that was released, they divided the likely impacts into seven categories, ranging from ocean pollution through metal toxicity and sediment plumes to impacts on biodiversity and ecosystems through direct impacts as well as light and noise pollution. Let's start with those.
There's many species that also deep dive. Whales and other cetaceans, different dolphins and sharks are known to deep dive right down to the 2 and 3 kilometre under the surface. The impacts are quite varied, unlike what the mining companies portray. And in fact, they use the term desert. They say it's an ecological desert down there.
In fact, that's pretty close to how the Prime Minister of the Cook Islands described the process in an interview with Radio New Zealand in November of 2020.
What we know for sure is there is very little marine life at that ocean depth, but it does exist in very small microscopic forms and other forms, of course.
In fact, there's a myriad of these amazing organisms that are just, you know, weird and wonderful. They're like nothing that we see on land because they've become adapted to life in the deep. And life in the deep is nothing like we terrestrial land lovers know. So the kinds of creatures that have evolved to live and reproduce down there are very different to organisms that we know. And, you know, in their own way, are stunning, are beautiful, all sorts of glowing starfish and fish. And just a few months ago, early this year, there was a new species of shark that was discovered that glows, its underbelly glows to attract organisms to it so it can prey on them. They're attracted to the light.
These aren't microscopic forms that are reliant on ocean health to survive. Whale sharks and leatherback turtles, deep sea diving whales and seabirds would all be impacted. Most oceanographers and marine biologists are quick to highlight how much we have to learn about the depths of the aquatic worlds we live beside. But this isn't all fluffy bunnies and animal rights.
The space in the ocean that's between the deep ocean and the surface, where many species, including those that are of commercial interest and are commercially valuable, tuna fisheries and other fisheries, you know, migrate through that midwater area.
The fisheries of the Pacific are the backbone of its economy. The region supplies more than half of the world's tuna, estimated at around $26 billion US dollars each year. What is more, small-scale subsistence and artisanal fisheries are vital to Pacific Islanders, and it is these Pacific communities who will be on the front lines of the resulting impacts should deep-sea mining go ahead. Fisheries are a vital part of their economies. From subsistence food to income from fisheries and tourism, many Pacific cultures also have cultural and spiritual attachments to the oceans, both to specific species and specific marine areas and processes, which have become part of their traditional customs and marine management practices. The clan chief of Duke of York Islands in Papua New Guinea has been quoted as saying, "When they start mining the seabed, they'll start mining part of me." Often the opposition to these plans is organized by indigenous communities. In February of 2020, a group of Fijian chiefs spoke out against seabed mining in the area, where the head chief, Ratu Williame Katonivere, stated that they wouldn't allow seabed mining to take away their source of livelihood, and that the potential resources and revenues of precious minerals or oil didn't outweigh the harm.
What our report also showed was, even though we could make this prediction with confidence about the severity of impacts, there are vast gaps in our knowledge about deep sea ecosystems, especially how those ecosystems relate to the midwater and surface ecosystems that we humans rely on for sustenance, both at a subsistence level for communities and local income generating level, but also our big international fisheries and all the downstream processing that that goes with those fisheries rely on the health of these water bodies.
Helen has already mentioned one of the more famous deep sea creatures, sharks. In Latangai, an island in Papua New Guinea, communities have developed a unique way of shark catching called shark calling, where the shark callers use rattles of coconut shells to mimic the sounds of a school of tuna. Using traditional knowledge, the sharks come to their boats and are caught by hand. Since Nautilus Minerals, that very first deep-sea mining company, had been exploring in the region, the sharks have not returned, likely due to a combination of noise pollution and water pollution. For the Kontu communities of Latangai, the loss of shark calling culture is a loss of livelihood, food security, and spiritual beliefs.
There's a high level of uncertainty about exactly how the disturbances of seabed mining will affect those other species, even the species that don't situate their lives right in the deep ocean floor. But we do know that there's going to be severe interruptions to their life cycles.
Nor would this be confined to the Pacific Ocean alone. Another unknown highlighted by the report was the impact that deep-sea mining could have on the carbon cycles within the ocean floor. Although the scientific community is in agreement that the Earth's oceans play a critical role as a carbon sink, possibly the largest on the planet, at 25% of all CO2 emissions, there isn't consensus on exactly how much or exactly how. While previous estimates have put the ocean carbon capture at 2 billion tons of CO2 per year, a recent World Economic Forum paper found that it could be almost 1 billion tons larger per year, meaning 67 billion rather than 43 billion tons of carbon since 1992. Messing with the unfamiliar could reverse the climate mitigation measures that deep-sea mining companies purport to be achieving in what is already a delicate balance.
We don't know what the impacts of deep-sea mining will be on carbon cycling and, in fact, nutrient cycling in general within the ocean and the chemistry of the whole ocean environment. We know that the seabed plays an important role in sequestering carbon. It's not known what's going to happen when the seabed is churned up and carbon may be released, or at least the processes that sequester carbon may not be able to function. And so that's mainly done through microbes and disturbing those microbes.
Moreover, the ocean is already suffering from how it has continued to capture and store carbon. Although it has decelerated the carbon accumulation in the atmosphere, this has come at the cost of marine chemistry, driving ocean acidification. Because ocean acidification is such a new phenomenon, we're not fully sure to what degree, at what pace, or through which pathways it will be most damaging, but it has already begun to hurt coral reefs, open ocean planktonic ecosystems, shellfish mortality, and vulnerable deep-sea organisms, as well as all the way up the food chain to us. Given all of these impacts, it's unsurprising that there has been considerable resistance to the proposed deep-sea mines in the region. Let's turn for a moment to someone who has been directly involved in that resistance.
There are a lot of people who have issues with it, and I think there would be a lot more people who had issues with the direction we're going if they were more informed of the environmental impacts that are likely to occur.
Speaking is Teura Tera Pasfield, a representative for the Deep Sea Minerals Campaign, as part of the Te Ipukarea Society, a Cook Islands environmental group. The Cook Islands have so far been the most foot forward when it comes to advancing with deep sea mining, and this hasn't come without opposition. The problem is that right now, so much of the debate is pure speculation. Like Helen, Teura references the precautionary principle, and the current drive to power ahead without the adequate evidence flies in the face of that. And although this evidence is being gathered at the moment, as Teura points out, this research is hardly unbiased.
So part of the exploratory license requirements are that companies do have to collect baseline environmental data, and a lot of the things that they have to collect are already prescribed by the International Seabed Authority. So there are things that they specifically have to collect. But it's not true that that's the only avenue for research. We should have really focused and tried a little bit harder to get some more of that independent research before taking this route. We note, TIS notes, that there were two expeditions that went out last year or the year before to do some research, and it was a perfect opportunity to get some biological data, but they didn't. And when they were asked why they didn't, they said that unfortunately those boats weren't equipped for that sort of research. So that gives some sort of indication of the weight that's being placed on environmental research and data. Ideally, with independent research, we wouldn't have to worry about incentives. The incentive for independent researchers isn't the potential for economic gain, but it's just the actual research itself.
This speaks to a genuine conflict between a desire and an acute need for development in the region, and wariness around at what cost that development might come.
But it's inevitable that for a country that is 99.99% ocean, that we will turn to our ocean for our livelihood, for our survival. And particularly during this time of COVID, when our tourism industry is essentially zero, it's important for us to look at diversifying the economy. And of course, with the demand for the minerals that are held in our nodules, drives even further the need for more research, exploration, to fully understand the marine environment, to see if we can extract these nodules without damaging the ocean.
That's Mike Brown again, Prime Minister to the Cook Islands, in an interview with Radio New Zealand in November 2020.
And our Honourable Prime Minister, he did say that he spoke about having an obligation to our people to harvest the resources that we've been given to make our lives better.
We're quite comfortable that in our consultations with our people, they see that the need for us to diversify the economy. Our people have grown accustomed to a level of prosperity that we had under tourism. And we need to look at ways at how we can maintain that. And the minerals program gives us an option. The global demand for these metals, as you illustrated, through conversion to renewables, the movement towards electric vehicles, is predicting a significant demand, particularly for metals like nickel and cobalt, copper, which are in these minerals.
But I think where we're coming from is we believe the obligation is really to make sure that our people are properly informed of the potential risks. So whether people support or oppose the industry, that stance that people can take is informed by best evidence, not by vague reassurances that we're going to do the research and if there's any environmental damage, we'll stop. I don't think that that's enough.
The basis of these concerns is the application of both the precautionary principle and free, prior and informed consent for the indigenous peoples, where the operational word here is informed. Pressure is on from all sides, and a decision for resources now could have long-term costs for the citizens of islands like the Cook Islands, particularly when so much is unknown.
And we have asked for no new calls for exploration until the Moraimoana Marine Spatial Plan is done. And under this current call for tenders for exploration, we've also said not to finalise those until the special unique marine areas are noted on the map so that people know which areas to avoid. If you want to avoid serious harm, the potential for serious harm, we should have these areas of conservation significance mapped out. And we need to seriously put effort into finding independent researchers.
Some of that research has been done by people like Helen Rosenbaum and the Deep Sea Mining Campaign. Whilst we discussed the impacts of deep sea mining, we hadn't yet considered some of the questions Te Ura was raising, such as exactly how these companies plan to mine over 200 metres down into the deep sea.
Well, we just don't even know the scope and the scale of the impacts that that will have. But certainly deep sea mining will disturb everything that's on the surface of the deep sea and to quite a few metres below that surface. That entirely runs counter to the public relations spin of companies, particularly companies like Deep Green. You can view Deep Green's videos online and see very sanitised, very clean versions of quite cute looking machines vacuuming, as they describe it, vacuuming up these nodules on the sea floor, just doing a little tidy up perhaps of the messy sea floor. It shows nothing of the plumes that are going to be generated, plumes of clouds of sediment that are going to be churned up in the very soft mud down there by these tractors going over them. And it shows nothing of the plumes of waste that's going to be discharged in somewhere in the midwater. They don't even know where they're going to discharge it yet.
This sounds like they haven't worked out their operational system yet, and so seems as though there are some pretty sizable logistics gaps which need to be addressed. But even at the most entry level, do we have the technology?
The technology is not there at all for deep sea mining. The Belgian company GSR has been the most transparent and the most active in actually trying to develop a system for deep sea mining. It ran some pilot trials a few months ago and came a bit unstuck, literally, when its mining machine broke from the cable that was attaching it to the surface. And GSR has said, well, you know, it's still investigating the feasibility of this, but they seem to imply that the jury's still out in terms of whether they think it's going to be a viable proposition or not.
Glamorous as they sound on initial proposition, neither 40 Leagues Under the Sea nor a foray into science fiction may be much of a reality anytime soon. And if they are, there are innumerable questions that still need to be answered. Instead, let's consider the third of those proposals from the beginning. Urban mining. Urban mining is a catchy term for what can really be understood as waste mining. It uses secondary sources, otherwise known as rubbish, and repurposes it, reclaiming metals and compounds from anything humans have already worked on, like infrastructure and used products.
Urban mining offers a possibility to recycle the metals within electronic waste in a safe way and in a way that can be distributed in amongst different communities for local income generation, whether that's here in developed countries at the source of pollution, closer to the source of pollution, or whether it is in developing countries to allow them to generate safe income out of this waste, to see the waste as a source of new materials and wealth, actually.
In some ways, that's a win-win-win. Source minerals, address the waste problem and its polluting and health impacts, and generate income for countries which have historically been forced to store the world's rubbish. Plus, it might actually be something we could operationalize in the near future.
The technology is far closer to being realized than deep sea mining's technology. It can occur on land. It doesn't require very sophisticated technology to do it. Until we actually explore these low-hanging fruit, these really obvious win-win solutions such as that urban mining presents, there's no argument at all to go and mess up another until now intact ecological system of the deep ocean.
Helen went on to describe one of the many cutting-edge research companies in Australia at the University of New South Wales and in New Zealand. One called Meat was particularly compelling in its pitch.
They describe it as a recession-proof enterprise that doesn't depend on the world economy and how the world economy is doing for it to maintain profitability, because there's a constant supply from our waste stream, and there's also the prospect of being able to re-mine tailings waste out of tailings dams and other tailings dumps. So there's a huge range of sources of waste materials that can be fed into urban mining.
The total value of materials contained in e-waste is estimated at $62.5 billion.
The challenge of the recycling of the small electronic equipment is a very interesting challenge. There are 2 billion small electronic equipment that are sold on the planet. The vast majority of them are lost somehow. They're lost in your drawers. Just imagine today that you would be able to recover those 2 billion. You would recover about 50 tons of gold, 500 tons of silver, 20,000 tons of copper and cobalt. So there is a real business case in order to sort of recover this material and to put it back into service. So we're closing the loop here.
The crux of urban mining comes back to another idea that has been bandied about in the environmental and sustainability world almost too much. circular economies. A circular economy is a system where, instead of linear product development, where a resource is turned into a product destined to become waste, it is in some way repaired, reused, or recycled. Now, this may be one of the buzzword phrases for sustainability in the last couple of years. Conversations around the circular economy have boomed and find themselves in boardrooms from the smallest of NGOs to the major manufacturers like Unilever and the changemakers like WEF. However, as a concept, the circular economy is so broadly applied that it is often hard to pin down.
At heart, my definition of it would be that circular economy is about ensuring that as much materials are put back into a closed loop so that you are, where possible, you know, reusing, recycling, and generally repurposing so that you're not losing materials in the same way that you would from a linear economy where you're just mining, processing, using, and pumping. Clearly, the idea of a circular economy is absolutely crucial if we're going to get to the point of having, you know, a sustainable world and a world in which the climate crisis is solved. However, I would say it really isn't enough.
Andy Whitmore is one of the founders of the London Mining Network, an alliance of human rights and development organizations which work towards holding mining companies accountable for social, environmental, and labor rights abuses. A circular economy is the first step towards reducing the production of mining companies, because as minerals flow back into the system, fewer need to be mined at all. But as Andy argues, this is only the first step.
And I think part of the problem is that, and we're seeing this at the moment in terms of what's required for the energy transition, is that you can have a circular economy which is still forever growing. So you can keep recycling, etc., you will still need to keep putting in more and more materials in order for the economy to grow. And at the moment, you know, that doesn't seem sustainable to me. And certainly at the level that, you know, huge level that we're using resources at the moment, continually increasing, you know, that's a real concern.
It is inarguable that we will need more mineral resources for the renewable energy technologies that are currently in development, for wind turbines and solar panels, electric vehicles and storage technologies. The Climate Smart Mining team of the World Bank published a report in 2020 which acknowledged how mineral intensive a low carbon future would be, and that whilst technology and sub-technology choice, material substitution and technological improvement will shift this demand, any lower carbon pathway will increase the overall demand. Whilst it addressed recycling and reuse, the authors didn't believe it would meet even half the current shortfall. But they also didn't address the potential for urban mining, likely because it's rarely discussed and little understood. But underlying this assumption is that our consumption of energy will remain the same, even as our source of energy shifts.
I think there are people who are arguing this green growth idea that you have electrical vehicles will save us. The idea that electrical vehicles just replace one internal combustion engine car and maybe even more, we can just keep producing more and more of them. I don't think that's going to work in the long run, because in many ways, electrical vehicles, you know, require more raw materials than internal combustion engine cars. So yes, they don't use fossil fuels, but they're not in themselves a solution. And so we should be looking at other solutions around the transport we use. Do we really need individually owned vehicles that for the vast majority of the time just sit on roads? Be nothing, you know. So, you know, should we be looking more towards transport systems we use, etc.?
For example, predictions for the mineral demands of the future often make assumptions about what we'll need. By 2050, according to a 2020 article in a science journal, the global EV stock will need to jump to 965 million passenger cars. A recent report by War on Want challenges this notion that a just transition would simply translate what we currently use into electric sources. It asks, is it reasonable, just, or necessary to deploy an estimated 1 billion electric vehicles in the decades to come? Will most of these vehicles be privately owned rather than dedicated to public transport or other vital services? Will most of them be used in the global north and not the global south?
I think it's fascinating that I've been working on mining as an issue, you know, working with local communities for about 3 or 4 decades now. And I remember it was only a couple of decades ago, I was at a conference in the Philippines where, you know, local communities were talking about, you know, mining. And it was the first time that someone had actually said, the problem isn't necessarily with our communities. The problem is actually with consumption in your countries. And you're coming here for solidarity. And actually what you need to be doing is working out what we do about your consumption. After that, I pretty much heard that again at every conference, and it's been growing and growing and growing. I think what's interesting now is that I would consider my job very much about previously going to communities and trying to ensure that companies that were either based in or financed from my country were held to account. I now consider that what I should be doing is working out where our consumption is fitting in and what we can do about it. It's taken me a couple of decades to get to that point. I think that is a crucial way for everyone to start looking at these issues, really. Who cares?
Rather than transitioning our entire world to electric, this begs the question whether this is a way of life that needs to be maintained at all. Take the electric car illustration, for example. A casual estimate is that there are currently around 1.5 billion vehicles in the world right now. One in every five of those cars are in the US. Not only would it be incredibly challenging to produce 1.5 billion electric vehicles, for all the reasons we've discussed, Andy's arguing that perhaps we don't need to. Should we own fewer cars? Should we invest in public transport and infrastructure? Should we consider urban planning more carefully so that access to schools and shops and basic services doesn't require a car? Do we need to have lorries and trucks on the road for all our delivery purposes? Are there modal shifts, like remote work, that would reduce our need for vehicles? Once our demand has reduced, will we move away from single ownership of cars towards community use so that even though they're still needed, it will not be at the same scale? These are some of the more fundamental questions that this approach takes. Rather than a pure renewable energy transition, it is a change in the approach to how we see energy use at all stages of the supply chain.
An interesting concept that I like, which is the idea of a circular society. Having mentioned that idea that a circular economy can be forever going, and because it's focused on the economy, the idea of a circular society is much more, do we really need these things? Within a societal viewpoint, is it really circular and how can it be circular?
But of course, it isn't just cars. A circular economy would be reducing consumption on all fronts: transport, product development, power, and heating.
Consumption is one of the main drivers. The multiple crises that we're facing, of which the most obvious is the climate crisis. And I do think it's actually up to governments to look to reduce overconsumption through, for instance, legally binding targets to reduce resource use. And this is happening. The European Parliament has come up with its first ever EU targets to reduce overconsumption, with MEPs voting for it to reduce resource use by 2030 and to bring EU consumption within planetary boundaries by 2050. We're at a point where something that seems fairly inconceivable for many people, I think, is the solution, is the area we should be moving towards.
Andy is right. Inconceivable is probably an understatement for how a concept like this, the wide-scale reduction of consumption, would be received by many in the Western world. And yet it is an idea that has slowly been gaining traction over the past decade, and one which might accelerate as the renewable energy transition comes around the corner. Energy efficiency isn't sexy, and it certainly isn't politically palatable, which means consumption reduction will be even less so. Asking people to change their behavior is challenging at the best of times, not least when it requires a sector-wide reform.
There are technologies which will help, definitely. However, I don't think that it's primarily a technological question. So, we can improve things and make things more circular. But I think it's going to be very difficult for us to shift our economies away from ones that are focused on growth to ones that are focused on well-being.
There has often been a tension in climate change action circles between those proposing radical reform and incremental change. Some would substitute technologies and divert finances to solve the symptoms of the Industrial Revolution. Others call for a more fundamental rethink of the modern society, the way we extract, consume, and use the resources around us, and the impact this has on the planet and our marginalized peoples. Some prioritize speed, and as the need for the planet to reach peak emissions draws ever closer and ever more urgent, that speed is needed. But without re-examining the pathways we choose to get there, we risk creating more ecological disasters in our wake, and with it, putting at risk the very communities climate change action is supposed to protect. The preceding episodes have looked at the mineral supply chain that will get us the technologies we need. The following episodes will look at how those technologies are implemented and the cost of clean energy.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the episode. To stay up to date with all the latest news from us, you can follow us on Twitter at BHRRC or search for Business and Human Rights Resource Centre on LinkedIn. Be sure to subscribe to This Way Up wherever you get your podcasts. Keep tuning in, and if you like what you hear, share with your networks.